The Lord be with you.
And
also. A reading from the Gospel according to Luke. Then the devil led Jesus to Jerusalem, made him stand on the parapet of the temple, and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here, for it is written, 'He will command his angels concerning you to guard you, and with their hands they will support you, lest you dash your foot against a stone.'" Jesus said to him in reply, "It also says, 'You shall not put the Lord your God to the test.'" When the devil had finished every temptation, he departed from him for a time. The Gospel of the Lord. Please be seated. In our last talk, we considered whether we might sometimes be seeking from people what we should be seeking from God, things like esteem, affirmation, fulfillment, love. But now, what about that relationship with God? You remember we spoke about how when two parties have made a covenant, there might be a period of testing of the covenant partner, and how God was testing Israel to see whether they would live out their side of it. Well, what about vice versa? Could Israel test God? Can we test God to see whether he is going to live out his side of the covenant? But it doesn't work that way. This is what Moses told the people of Israel in the book of Deuteronomy, from which Jesus is quoting in this passage. "You shall not put the Lord your God to the test, as you did at the waters of Meribah." That is what that generation there in the wilderness attempted. But our relationship with God is not equal. It is mutual. It is two-way. It is a real relationship with a back and forth, and certainly a great deal of love and communication. But we are not equal partners. Indeed, if we consider the relationship between God the Father and God the Son, who are co-equal and co-eternal, nevertheless, we see that there's a distinctive shape to it. That as John Paul II wrote, and I'm paraphrasing, the Son receives everything from the Father and gives everything back in love. There is a certain something like obedience seen in God the Son and in Jesus Christ, the Word made flesh, true God and true man. We saw that that took the form, as he said in the Garden of Gethsemane, "Not my will, but yours be done." And as he taught us also to say in the Our Father prayer, "Thy will be done." This relationship on the part of Jesus, this openness, this reception, this obedience to the Father's will was the key to what he was accomplishing on earth and what he continues to accomplish in us and through us. Now, Jesus' 40 days in the desert were not the only time that he set aside a concentrated period of time for a relationship with the Father. to hear him, to speak with him, to keep that going. It seems every chapter in the Gospels we're seeing him go away at night to pray, and even teaching his disciples to do so, as when he told them to come aside and rest a while. We seem to see this most frequently when the crowds don't respect the limits and pursue him anyway. And in the Gospels, we see examples of the actual text of his prayers, what he actually said. And often, he said he was saying his prayers out loud, speaking to the Father out loud, so that we could hear him and discover something about the truth of that relationship. This was his fundamental identity and relationship, to be the Son of the Father. And we see how he lived it. And we also need to live out our relationship, our adoption as sons and daughters in him, the only begotten Son. And thus we're here at this day of recollection. For we need that time set aside to communicate with God. And of course, as many of you know well, taking the time on occasion, several times a year for a day of recollection, is something that fits in well along with going to Mass at least every Sunday and setting aside at least some time for prayer every day. Not surely from 8:30 to 2 every day, but sometime, something daily. And so it forms a rhythm, the daily thing, the weekly thing, the monthly or seasonal thing. But as we cultivate that relationship with God, as Jesus did, we may want it to be a certain way. We may want certain things to happen. And so Satan's temptation enters in. To be caught in midair, spectacularly in front of everyone at the temple. What affirmation by God that would make us feel. What glory from the people we would receive if that happened to us. For we ourselves could wish to receive such a favor, such a visible favor from God. And for Jesus, how quick a way of accomplishing salvation, if that brought everyone to faith. How effective, especially how painless. What if we could manipulate God to do that? What if we knew that if we jumped off something very high, that would force him to catch us? Would we do it? Would we be tempted to do it if we knew for sure that it would work? Wouldn't it be a pick-me-up on a cold, rainy day? Somewhat like this, perhaps a little more common, is that we might wish for something different in our relationship with God and our living this earthly life, different than what he has given us. We might wish that we had a different calling than that he's called us to. Perhaps you sometimes wish that you were a contemplative monk or a contemplative nun who could spend all their time praying, who might even have mystical experiences. You ever wish you had that rather than the calling that you have? Or you might wish that God had given you different gifts to share with others. I always remember part of the correspondence between St. Therese and one of her sisters who was also there in her Carmelite convent, where the sister, having received Therese's report of some of what she had learned and experienced in a particular sort of weekend retreat, I think it was, and the sister says, "I always wish that God would give me those gifts." And Therese says, "You don't understand. He is giving you these gifts. He gives them to me to pass on. They're yours." But beyond wishing for a different calling or different gifts, there's always something we can wish for, and something that it looks like Jesus humanly wished for, a different way. That somehow the way, the actual day-to-day living of that calling and the use of those gifts would turn out differently, that it in fact turns out. It seems when we look at the Gospels that Jesus at times wished that he could carry out his mission with no pain, which clearly is a very human, very natural, understandable, and non-sinful thing to wish for. We see this reflected even in when St. Peter, after having confessed him as the Christ, then objected to his message that he was going to have to go and suffer and die. And now Jesus responded to him and said, "Get behind me, Satan." It seems that he recognized the voice of the tempter in that particular suggestion. And then we see how in the Garden of Gethsemane, he would pray, "If it is possible, let this cup pass from me." But then in all of this, he then turned and said, "But not my will, but yours be done." And ultimately, this will be our struggle too. For Jesus says, if we are to be his disciple, we must take up our cross daily and follow him. In baptism, we died with Christ. Something that's symbolized most successfully visually in the case of full immersion, and especially if it should be immersion into something in the shape of a tomb, as it was in one ancient church, where we go down into that water, and then we rise with him. We die with him and rise with him in sign. We die with him and rise with him in reality as the fruits of his paschal mystery were applied to our soul. But it is not yet complete at that point. For we will live out more completely dying with him and rising with him. The dying, the sacrifice, will happen during this earthly life. The resurrection will come later, on the last day. But who wants to suffer? St. Paul wrote, "Now I rejoice in my sufferings for your sake, and in my flesh I am filling up what is lacking in the afflictions of Christ on behalf of his body, which is the church." It is a mysterious sentence to understand intellectually. It is a mysterious sentence to grasp in the heart. And yet surely our vocation in Christ is clear, that we are called to be conformed to Christ more and more, individually conformed to him, collectively as a body conformed to him in the church. And therefore, what lies ahead for each of us, individually and collectively, will be suffering, crucifixion, and death. whatever exact form that takes. And then through it, as through a passage, a Passover, the glory of the resurrection. The suffering we see, it's real. Do we see the resurrection? Do we see it with the eyes of faith? St. Paul wrote in his letter to the Romans, "I consider that the sufferings of this present time are as nothing compared with the glory to be revealed for us." This then is the plan. What do we think of that plan? Salvation? Through suffering? Why make such a plan? Well, for one thing, there's an awful lot of suffering in the world. It's very plentiful raw material. And if that raw material that is actually the product of sin and wasn't supposed to be here in the first place can become what is transformed in something that might perhaps be almost like a nuclear reaction into salvation. What is it that it makes? It is love that is made by suffering, that is revealed by it, that is refined and fired and strengthened by it. God is love, and everyone who loves is begotten by God and knows God. Through our baptism, we have been given a share in the divine life, and that share is that charity, that self-giving love that so characterizes the life of the divine persons of the Trinity. And love never fails. So whether we like it, whether we understand it, whether we might wish for something different, this is the plan. This is what has been opened to us in Christ. This is what we signed up for by going into that baptismal tomb, because there's no other way to get through to the other side. And so with Jesus we say, "Not my will, but yours be done." The third evangelical counsel is obedience. Those who vow it in religious life vow it to their superior, whose directives then become the form of the voice of God in their life. And it's something that can extend to those in religious orders, to every little thing. Potentially, every little thing they could have to obey in. Now, though people, and especially today, think often first of chastity and celibacy as something that stands out as something difficult in that life, surely obedience turns out to be actually much harder and much more extensive. A sort of day-by-day filing down or crucible that really can transform the soul and make them saints and can make us saints too. We have not vowed obedience as they have. And yet again here too, we are called to it to the extent that is consistent with our vocation. And again, we may evaluate in what way is obedience to God something that supports our vocation, and have we done it? Should we seek to know God's will more often? Have we done so? Have we done it in big things? Have we done it in small things? If we look back over our lives, did we seek his will in where we would live? In where we would go to school? In what our vocation and state of life is? In who to marry? In how many children to have? How to raise them? In how to make all the myriad of choices that face us long-term or short-term? In how to spend the day or the hour? It is a strange and contradictory thing to try to live the Christian life by our own power and our own direction. And yet, how often do we try exactly that? The third Lenten practice is prayer. Prayer to listen to God's voice, to know his will, and to ask for the grace to accept it, to know and accept our calling, our gifts, our particular form of suffering. But let us not forget where it leads. As Lent leads to Easter, so this life, lived in union with the sacrifice of Christ, also leads to sharing in his resurrection on the last day. And that's so much better than being caught in midair. The devil said to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here, for it is written, 'With their hands they will support you, lest you dash your foot against a stone.'" Jesus said to him in reply, "It also says, 'You shall not put the Lord your God to the test.'" And so we come to the end of this day of recollection. We've taken this time to go with Jesus into the desert, to recollect or refocus upon the presence of God with us in our soul, and to regain our first love. We have been probed and tested by Jesus' temptations and how he responded in overcoming them. With regard to material possessions, we have been challenged to seek true riches in the evangelical counsel of poverty and the Lenten practice of fasting. With regard to human relationships, we've been challenged to love with respect and integrity for ourselves and for others in the spirit of the evangelical counsel of chastity and the Lenten practice of almsgiving. With regard to our relationship with God, we've been challenged to gain true freedom and fulfillment in seeking his will in the evangelical counsel of obedience and the Lenten practice of prayer. We read in the letter to the Hebrews, "Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast to our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has similarly been tested in every way, yet without sin. So let us confidently approach the throne of grace to receive mercy and to find grace for timely help."